Chapter 6. It was quite true. Within 2 days of being immersed in Eastern ways, climate, food, languages, faces, expressions, and forms of civility, Fox was a different man, a more agreeable one. While the Diane was refilling all her water casks except for half a dozen in the ground tier at Andra, and taking in wood, stores, livestock, arrack and tobacco, together with river water to wash the salt out of their harsh and rasping clothes at last, he took Jack and Stephen to Wittensorg, the country residence, and presented them to the governor, Stamford Raffles. Fox was proud of Raffles, and understandably so. He was a singularly accomplished and amiable man, and they both found their opinion of Fox changed when they saw how the governor valued him. Raffles at once invited them to stay, lamented the numerous dinner party to which they were necessarily condemned that afternoon, but promised that they should sup in private, and perhaps between the two meals Dr. Maturin might like to see a little of his garden and his collections. "For, if I don't mistake, sir, you're the gentleman to whom we owe Testudo Aubrey. And, good heavens, now I come to reflect, perhaps the captain is that glorious reptile's godfather. What a delight to have two such famous names under our roof at the same time. Olivia, my dear!" But before Mrs. Raffles could be made aware of her happiness, urgent official messages came in requiring the governor's attention before dinner, and the visitors were taken to their rooms. The dinner was indeed a very grand affair, the guests seated with exact regard to precedence, for the Javanese and Malays, of whom there were several present, were even more particular about rank than the Europeans. The Sultan of Suakarta was on the governor's right, then came two major generals, then Jack, the senior naval officer present, and a long way farther down, Stephen sat between the captain of a recently arrived East Indiaman and a civil servant. Fox was at the other end, on Mrs. Raffles' right. Stephen's neighbours had been talking eagerly as they came in, and now, as they sat down, the civil servant on Stephen's right said to him, "I was just telling my cousin here that he mustn't worry about the news from London. These things are always exaggerated by distance, don't you agree, sir?"
"Certainly truth is hard to come by, near or far," said Stephen. "But what is the gentleman not to worry about? Is it said that London is burnt again, or the plague broken out? And surely you would have noticed these things before leaving. He would have brought the news himself."
"Why, sir," said the sailor, "the people here are all talking about the great losses on the stock exchange, the funds falling to pieces and banks breaking right, left and centre, particularly country banks. It's all since I left Blackwall."
"It may seem curious to you, Doctor," said the civil servant, "that we should have had the news before the Indiaman's arrival, but such is the case, for the company sometimes has overland messengers travelling down at a great pace across the Arabian Desert and Persia. The latest word is not 3 months old, but, as it always happens, the latest word is much deformed by rumour. Rumour loves to make its hearer's flesh creep, and as soon as the stock exchange sinks a little, rumour swears the bottom of the market has fallen out. Yet it takes an even greater delight in breaking banks. In my time, I've seen all the great houses brought down. Coots, Drummonds, Hawes, the whole shooting match. Believe me, Humphrey, there's nothing in it. And I speak as the governor's financial adviser."
When they were drinking coffee in the long, cool, shadowy drawing-room, Jack came over and said in an undertone, "By God, Stephen, how I hope you didn't take my advice about money. I've just heard two damned unpleasant things. The first's about the city and about a run on the banks. It seems that many have stopped payment and that many country houses are broke. Smith's was particularly named. The second is that the French have already reached Poulaprabang. They're there first, in spite of all our efforts." Before Stephen could reply, his left-hand neighbour at dinner came to say goodbye, and on seeing Jack, he claimed acquaintance.
He had been aboard one of the Indiamen in whose company Captain Aubrey, commanding the Surprise even then, had engaged a French line of battleship and a corvette and had obliged them to withdraw. By the time he'd finished fighting the battle over again, the room was almost empty, and the governor claimed Dr. Maturin. "It's rare," he said, "to have anyone who look at my collections as anything but a rare issue." "Banks would enjoy this beyond anything," said Stephen, stopping before an astonishing group of orchids growing from trees, crevices, baskets, or the ground itself. "He's very much more of a botanist than I. He showed me some of your drawings of the vanilla. There is the very plant. A friend sent me a root from Mexico, and I hope to naturalise it. The insignificant green thing in a hanging raft." Raffles broke off a piece of seed pod and gave it to Stephen, who bowed, smelt to it, and continued, "With the utmost appreciation, and yet with a certain regret, he saw so little when he was here in the Endeavour. I'm afraid he must have been in a sad way, but even if he'd been able to get about, he would have had to go very far to acquire anything like a true notion of the flora. There was nothing worth calling a botanical garden in those days. The Dutch looked upon the island with a commercial rather than a philosophical eye. Certainly few Dutch naturalists come to mind, apart from Van Buren, of course, for the fauna. To be sure, and he's a constellation in himself. I'm so sorry he's no longer here. We were great friends. But you'll no doubt meet him in Pulo Prabang, where, as I understand it, you mean to accompany Edward Fox. I shall look forward to it. But am I mistaken in supposing that he withdrew from Java because of the British conquest of the island? Quite mistaken, I'm happy to say. We're excellent friends. He dislikes Bonaparte as much as we do, like so many of the Dutch officials who are now working with us. His removal was settled upon well before our arrival, primarily for the sake of Mrs. Van Buren, who is a Malay lady from those parts, but also for the sake of the orangutan and some of the smaller gibbons, which are to be met with there and not here, to say nothing of the Galinae or Nectarinias. I've never been to Pulo Prabang, alas, but I understand it possesses all the advantages of Borneo without the drawback of headhunters. When they'd finished the Birds of Paradise aviary, which was no small undertaking, and when Stephen had expressed his unqualified support for Raffles' projected zoological society and garden in London, Raffles said, "It can hardly be necessary for a man of your reputation, but if you should care for a letter of introduction to Van Buren, nothing could be easier." "That would be very kind. Yet, on reflection, perhaps I ought to present myself at his door. If it were known that I had been introduced by the governor of Java, my character as a wholly unofficial naturalist travelling with his friend Aubrey might suffer. On the other hand, I may assume that you know the conditions of my attachment to Mr. Fox's mission." "Yes." "On the other hand, then, I should be most grateful if you would recommend me to a considerable merchant here, capable of dealing with bills of exchange, who has dealings with a colleague in Pulo Prabang." "You wouldn't object to a Chinese?" asked Raffles, having considered for a moment. "They carry out almost all the banking business, bill discounting and so on, in these regions." "Never in life. It was a Parsi or a Chinese I had in mind. I've always heard excellent accounts of their probity. The better sort can put John Company to shame. Here in Batavia we have Shao Yen, who has interests out as far as the Moluccas and up to Penang. He's under some obligation to me. I'll find out whether he has a correspondent in Pulo Prabang. I may have occasion to disburse considerable sums, and it might be more convenient to draw them locally than to carry them about. But my chief reason is that I wish to appear in Pulo Prabang as a man of substance from the outset, not as a mere moneyed adventurer. If I go to Shao Yen with your recommendation, he'll treat me with respect. This respect will be conveyed to his correspondent,
And an intelligent banker or merchant is often capable of giving valuable information. Yet, obviously, he's not going to do so for a stranger unless that stranger is uncommonly well vouched for. And although I can display quantities of gold and letters of credit, they wouldn't serve as well as a word from you. You flatter me. But I cannot pretend you're mistaken. I shall ask him to call tomorrow morning. What else can I do to be of assistance? Could your people give me a list of the members of the French mission? I'm afraid not. Apart from Duplessis and the infamous couple whose names you know already, their frigate only arrived a few days ago. It's already been removed from Prabang Harbour because the sailors made such a nuisance of themselves ashore. But Duplessis will not have audience of the Sultan until after the change of the moon. He's hunting with his cousin of Kowang in the hope of a two-horned rhinoceros. So much the better. Would it perhaps be possible to have a very brief sketch of the Sultan and his chief advisers? Certainly. As for the Sultan, of course, Fox knows everything about him, his Javanese ancestors, his wives, mothers-in-law, concubines, minions. But the office may turn up something new about his council. How those dear gibbons hoot and howl, upon my word. Did you hear the bell? I believe I did. Then perhaps we should go in. My wife thought of beginning with a dish that might amuse you. Bird's nest soup. And she maintains that soup must be at hot. But before we go, see if you can make out the big gibbon to the left of the Kazu Arena tree, even though the light's so poor. He is a Siamang. Oh, Frederick! The gibbon answered with a melodious hoo, 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 and the governor hurried in. "Pray, Captain Aubrey, tell us about your voyage," he said, his soup spoon poised halfway. "Well, sir," said Jack, "it was as uneventful as a voyage could well be until we were off an island in the Tristan group, and then it was on the point of becoming very, very much more eventful than we wished. There was a prodigious swell setting from the west, and as we lay there off Inaccessible, for that's the island's name, the breeze died away to a clock calm. We were rolling so as to spew our oakum. And although we'd sent up preventer stays and swifted the shrouds... Oh, but I'm afraid, sir, I used too many sea terms. Not at all, not at all. I believe, Captain, that I was at sea well before you. Indeed, sir, forgive me, I had no idea. Yes. I was born aboard my father's ship, a West Indiaman off Jamaica. The rest of the evening was passed with voyages, passages to India and beyond, some extraordinarily fast, some extraordinarily slow, and with an account of Jack's friend Duval carrying the news of the Battle of the Nile to Bombay by way of the desert and the Euphrates. Shao Yen was a tall, thin man, in a plain grey robe, more like an austere monk than a merchant, but he grasped the situation at once. They spoke in English, he having had much to do with the East India Company's people in Canton in his youth, and having lived in Macau during the two recent English occupations, as well as in Penang. Raffles left them together after a few general remarks of a friendly nature, and when the proper civilities were over, Stephen said, "When I go to Pulau Prabang, it may be necessary for me to purchase the goodwill of certain influential men. For this purpose, I have a fair amount of gold. It appears to me that the best way of proceeding would be to deposit it with you, and subject, of course, to the usual commissions and charges, to carry a letter of credit to your correspondent in Pulau Prabang and to draw on him." Shao Yen replied, "Certainly. But when you say a fair amount, have you any approximate sum in mind?" It's made up of different currencies. It would weigh about 300 weight. Then may I observe that if either or both of my correspondents, for I have two, were to scrape the iron bare, they could not produce a tenth part of the amount you speak of. It is a very poor island. But in my opinion, that tenth part, Tocqueville presented, would buy all the goodwill that is to be had.
In this case, there's likely to be some competition.
Yes, said Shaoyan. He looked down for a few moments and then said, it might answer very well if I were to give you a letter of credit for what I believe my correspondent can produce, and then notes of hand for various sums. My paper is good from Penang to Macau. That would answer admirably, thank you. And may I beg you to impress upon your correspondent that I should wish any large transaction to be entirely confidential. Ordinary money-changing may as well be public as not, but I should be sorry if it were thought I could be squeezed for thousands.
Shaoyan bowed, smiled, and said,
I have two correspondents, both from Shantung and both discreet. But Ling Lang has the smaller house. He is less conspicuous, and perhaps I should direct your letter of credit to him.
Having drunk tea with Shaoyan and eaten little cakes from a multitude of trays, Stephen looked for Jack Aubrey, but found to his disappointment that he had already set off for Anja to bring the Diane up to Batavia so that not a moment should be lost.
Poor soul, Stephen reflected. He'll take his mind off this foolish rumour.
For his own part, he was satisfied by the financial expert's words, and he spent the first part of the day with Raffles' Javanese peacock, far finer than the Indian bird, a friendly Bincherong, the gardens, where he was joined by Mrs. Raffles in an apron and leather gloves, and the enormous Hortus siccus. Such a pleasant forenoon. Dinner was less agreeable, however. Before it, Fox introduced him to three high officials who were to join the mission, almost caricatures of their kind, tall, red, thick, arrogant, with booming voices and an inexhaustible store of platitudes. Their conversation was dull, almost past believing. And afterwards, Fox said, I'm sorry to have inflicted this upon you, but they are necessary properties on the present stage. We have to produce a show at least equal to what the French can offer. It appears that they have three gentlemen, apart from the two traitors who are not regularly accredited, and the servants. And these people the governor's lent me are used to missions of this kind. They can stand there in their gold-laced uniforms for hours without suffering. They can give the appearance of listening to speeches. They never have to steal away to the privy, and at banquets they're capable of eating anything from human flesh downwards. But I admit that their company is a trial.
Vous l'avez voulu, Georges Dandon?
Yes. And I can bear it for the voyage and the time of the negotiations. I could and would bear a great deal more to succeed in this undertaking. Apart from anything else, he added with a slight laugh, the governor tells me that if I bring back a treaty, and if he has the writing of the dispatch, it might mean a knighthood, even a baronetcy. For a moment, Stephen didn't know whether Fox was speaking seriously. But when, after a reflective pause, he went on to say, it would so please my mother, the doubt was resolved. The Diane came into Batavia with a leading wind and a making tide that afternoon, and Jack sent an official message to the effect that he hoped to sail at 11 the next morning. It was Seymour who brought the message, together with a private note to Stephen begging him to urge all those concerned to exact promptitude, to give an example himself, and to suggest that the governor might like to visit the ship.
And I was to say, sir, he was very sorry you weren't aboard as we sailed past Thwartway Island, because we were surrounded by those swallows that make bird's nest soup. I should like it of all things, said Raffles, on hearing the suggestion. There's nothing in its way more beautiful than a man of war. Nor anything, alas, more rigorously dominated by time and barrels. I'm so glad you're coming. Your presence will oblige the others to show a leg, as we say. They showed a leg, whether they liked it or not. For Raffles was as regular as a well-tempered chronometer, and a procession of boats headed by the governor's barge set out for the Diane at 9:45. She was looking beautiful, more beautiful than any ship that had been wooding, watering, and taking in stores at such furious speed could be expected to look. But then her captain and her first lieutenant were perfectly aware of the effect of yards exactly squared by the lifts and the braces, the sails furled in a body, and of the quantity of unsightly objects that could be concealed under the hammock cloths drawn drum tight and with never a wrinkle. And in any case, the smoke of the 13-gun salute would hide a number of imperfections, while the ceremony of reception diverted attention from any that might be visible through the clouds. This ceremony had been rehearsed 3 times since dawn, and it passed off perfectly well. The barge hooked on, the white-gloved side-boys ran down with baize-covered man-ropes to make the ascent almost foolproof, the boatswain and his mates sprung their calls, the Diane's 40 marines, red as lobsters and perfect to the last button, presented arms with a fine simultaneous clash as the governor and the envoy came aboard, welcomed by Captain Aubrey and all his officers in their best uniforms. The day was hot and cloudless, and since the great cabin was divided up, Jack had caused an awning to be stretched over the after part of the quarter-deck. Here he and his guests sat, drinking sherbet or Madeira, and talking or contemplating the broad harbour with its great numbers of European ships, Chinese junks, Malay proas, and innumerable boats and canoes plying to and fro. And in the meantime, the mission's additional baggage and servants came aboard on the larboard side. At 10:15, Raffles asked if he might be shown the ship. He walked round with Jack and Fielding, making intelligent, appreciative comments. And when he was brought back to the quarter-deck, he called his people, said farewell to the mission, thanked Jack heartily for his entertainment, and went down into the barge once more with the usual honours, once more with the roar of guns. Jack's eye followed the boat with great approval, and as soon as it was at a proper distance, he said to Richardson, the officer of the watch, "Let us get under way." With the boatswain piping all hands to unmoor ship, the frigate sprang to ordered life. She was fast to the chain moorings laid down long ago for Dutch men-of-war, and it took her little time to cast them off and spread her topsails to the moderate westerly breeze. She made her cautious way through the merchant shipping, some of it wonderfully stupid, and as 11 bells in the forenoon watch struck, she cleared the harbour. "Now that's the kind of visitor I really like," said Jack, joining Stephen in the cabin. "A man who knows just when to come and just when to go. They're wonderfully rare. We'll drink a bottle of Latour to his health." He took off his massive gold-laced coat and tossed it onto the back of a chair. It slipped off as the Diane heeled the thrust of her t'gallantsails, and Killick, appearing as though from a mouse-hole, snatched it up and carried it away, muttering, "Fling it at Bearlock, it was all right. Best cluster broadcloth. Brushed all over again. Toil, toil, toil." "You look worn, brother," said Stephen. "To tell you the truth," said Jack with a smile, "I am rather worn. Wooding and watering at top speed's a wearing occupation, particularly when the hands are all so eager for liberty to kick up bobs a-dying on shore after so many months at sea.
We did lose 10, not having time to comb through all the bawdy houses or the backsides of go-downs. Still, that does allow us to shift hammocks forward to make room for all these new servants. Preposterous numbers of servants. And then again, I believe we can look forward to less anxious sailing now. We're directly in the path of the Indiamen bound for Canton until we have to steer east a little south of the line. And although the waters are dangerous, I have Muffet's very careful charts as well as his directions. And Muffet, you know, made the voyage more often than any other man in the company's service. A better hydrographer, in my opinion, than Horsburgh or even Dalrymple.
Jack Aubrey, however, was reckoning without his guests. The three necessary properties designed to give the mission greater weight, or at least greater bulk, were called Johnston, Crab and Loader, a judge and two members of the council, who had reached their present rank by outliving and outsitting all competitors. And when the Diane, having made her way through the close-clustered Thousand Islands and having crossed the notorious Toulang Shoal with 3 fathoms to spare, was approaching the Banker Strait, Johnstone met Stephen on the half-deck, the one coming, the other going. Stephen had never known a judge he liked. Those few he had met or seen in court had been self-important, prating men, unequal to their great authority. And Johnston was a particularly unfortunate example. After a few insipid remarks, he said, "I, too, am very fond of music. Nobody loves a tune better than I do, but I always say enough is as good as a feast, don't you agree? And I'm one of those curious people that are no good unless they have a good night's sleep. I'm sure the captain doesn't know how permeable the cabin walls are, permeable to sound, I mean. But I hope I may rely upon you to be good enough to drop a hint. Just a very gentle, diplomatic hint. As to your position that enough is as good as a feast, Judge, allow me to point out that it is contrary to the views of all good men from the earliest recorded times," said Stephen. "Think of the feasts in Paralipomenon in Homer, in Virgil. They were neither prepared by fools nor eaten by them. As for the rest, it's clear that you cannot know that I am Captain Aubrey's guest, or you would never have supposed that I could give him hints on how he should behave." Johnstone flushed with anger, said, "Then I shall do it myself," and turned away. He didn't do so at dinner, though he was obviously nerving himself for it, and although his friends kept looking at him. But the news reached Jack that evening when the frigate was threading the strait between Banka and Sumatra, less than 10 miles broad in places. The breeze was awkward, coming now from one shore, now from the other, and although the spectacle of forests on either hand separated by a stretch of sky-blue sea was agreeable for the passengers, Stephen in the maintop with the telescope was very nearly sure he'd seen a Sumatran rhinoceros, the continual tacking, the continual cry of the leadsman in the chains, sometimes calling less than 5 fathoms, and the continual possibility of uncharted shoals made it an active and uneasy passage for the seamen. At one point, Jack hurried below to check a warning in Muffet's papers, and while he was doing so, he heard Killick in the farther cabin giving Bondon a lively description of those old buggers and the way they carried on about the music. Apart from calling "Avast there," he took no notice, being too deeply concerned with his rocks. But it had sunk into the depths of his mind, and it rose up again after quarters, when the cabins had just been reassembled, and his violin case came up from the orlop. "Killick," he called, "go and see if His Excellency is at leisure for a visit." His Excellency was, and Jack went round at once. "My dear Mr. Fox," he cried, "I'm so sorry. I had no idea we made such a din." "Eh?"
said Fox, looking startled.
Oh, the music, you mean? Please don't feel the least concern. It's true I have no ear for music, no appreciation at all, but I cope with the situation perfectly well with little balls of wax. All I hear through them is a kind of general hum, which I find rather agreeable than otherwise. Soporific. I cannot tell you how relieved I am, but your companions... I do hope they haven't been making a fuss after all your kindness in arranging their quarters and their stores. They have little sense of what's fitting. They have none of them travelled in a man-of-war, only in companies, ships, where, of course, they are important people. I try to keep them in order, but they don't seem capable of understanding. One of them sent for Matcham this morning. Has the ship stopped?
Yes, we've anchored for the night. I dare not go through the strait in the darkness, not carrying Caesar, or at least Caesar's representatives and all his fortunes. Jack Aubrey rarely turned a compliment, but Foxy's unaffected, generous response really pleased him, the more so as it was unexpected. In fact, he wouldn't have dared go through the strait in any circumstances. It was a slow and anxious navigation with strong, varying currents to add to the difficulty. The old buggers remained perfectly indifferent to all this, however. They might have been travelling in a coach on a well-traced road. They none of them ever tackled Jack directly, but they made Fielding's life quite unhappy. Fleming was reported to him for having prevented Loder from talking to the quartermaster at the comm. He was told that it was extremely inconvenient to have their baggage struck down into the hold every evening, and that last time it happened, Crabbe's pencil case and a valuable fan hadn't been put back in the right place. It was at least half an hour before he could find them. And every evening in the strait, when the ship lay at anchor, Jack turned the hands up to sing and dance on the forecastle by way of a break after the arduous day, which was another cause for complaint. But the most usual grievance had to do with their servants, who were obliged to wait their turn at the galley, and who were treated with coarse jocularity, even with obscene gestures and expressions. In any case, Jack was far out of their reach. He and the master spent much of their time in the foretop, with azimuth compass and telescope at hand, and a midshipman to hold their papers flat. They saw, noted, and dealt with a number of hazards. And as the frigate was crossing the shoal that made leaving the strait so dangerous if the passage were missed, as she was, in fact, entering the South China Sea, they saw another peculiar to these waters. From an island to windward, laid down as Cungit by Horsburgh and Fungit by Muffet, came two large Malay proas. They had outriggers, and with the wind on their beam, they came up very fast. Presently it could be seen that their long, slim hulls were crowded with men, surprising numbers of men even for such an enterprise. Their intentions were perfectly obvious, piracy being a way of life in these parts. And although ships the size of the Diane were rarely attacked, it had happened on occasion, sometimes with success. "Mr. Richardson," called Jack. "Sir," came the answer. "Stand by to run out the guns as brisk as can be when I give the word. The hands are to keep out of sight." The proas separated, one on the frigate's larboard quarter, the other to starboard, and they approached cautiously, spilling their wind as they came. The tension mounted. The gun teams crouched by their pieces as motionless as cats. But nope, it was not to be. The proas hesitated, decided that this was a real man of war, not a merchant disguised, hauled their wind and were gone. A universal sigh along the gun deck, and the hand spikes were laid aside. For some reason, this stilled the old bugger's complaints for the following days, which was just as well, since just under the equator, the Diane had to leave the Indiaman's course and sail into uncharted, shallow seas traversed only by proas or junks,
which drew almost no water at all, whereas the frigate, with her present stores, drew 15 feet 9 inches abaft. Perhaps they were dimly aware of the gravity aboard, an atmosphere in which querulous words might meet with a short answer. Yet even so, Jack was glad to be rid of them at the end of the voyage, a voyage, indeed, that ended in beauty. After a night of ghosting along the parallel under close-reefed topsails, the lead going all the time, dawn showed the perfect landfall. A large, unmistakable volcanic island directly to leeward, with a fine breeze to carry them in. Jack kept to his reefed topsails, however. He wanted to give the Malays long warning of his arrival. He wanted the ship and the mission to have plenty of time for their preparations. He also meant to have his breakfast in comfort. This he accomplished together with Stephen, Fielding, and young Harper. And when it was over, they returned to the crowded quarterdeck, where Fox and his companions and all the officers were gazing at Pulau Prabang, now very much nearer. They gazed in silence, and apart from the sigh of the breeze in the rigging, the only sound in the ship was the measured chant of the man in the chains. By the deep, 12. By the deep, 12. And a half, 12. To be sure, it was an arresting sight. The island stretched wide across the field of vision, most of it dark green with forest, the truncated cone of the central volcano soaring up in a pure line beyond the level of the trees. There were other peaks, lower, less distinct, and perhaps much older in the interior, but they could only be made out by attentive inspection, whereas the craters they were approaching, the crater in the sky and the crater at sea level, couldn't conceivably be missed or mistaken. The second was an almost perfect circle a mile across, and its wall rose 10 and even 20 feet above the surface. Here and there a palm tree could be seen, but otherwise the ring was unbroken except in one place, the gap towards which the ship was heading. Though it's true that on the landward side it was obscured by the long, slow accumulation of earth and silt, the delta of the river on which the town was built. On one of the horns of this immense harbour wall stood a fort. Ancient, perhaps Portuguese, obviously deserted. Jack fixed it with his telescope, saw grass growing in the empty embrasures, and shifted his glass to the farther side, where something not unlike a castle stood apart from the houses, commanding the approach to the shore. A shore lined deep with craft of various kinds, and one that reminded him of Shelmerston. Though the strand was black, the vessels often masted with tripods of bamboo, their sails made of matting. Perhaps the common quality was a certain piratical air. By the mark, 10. The water was shoaling gradually, and from the slight surf on the outer wall it was clear that the tide was making. Jack considered the rest of the harbour. A certain amount of activity among the fishing boats and one of the big proas being careened. And the town? A mosque. Another mosque. Some houses built on piles along the river. A massive, formless affair that must be the Sultan's palace. By the deep, 9. And a half, 9. By the deep, 9. Houses in large gardens or compounds round the town. Green fields beyond, some bright green. Rice paddies, no doubt. All the flat ground cultivated, rising forest beyond. He focused his glass on the entrance to the harbour, 100 yards wide, nodded, glanced at the boats ready to be hoisted out, at the best bower a cockbill,
at Mr. White with his guns. And turning to the master, he said, "The middle of the channel, Mr. Warren, and round to at 8 fathom or a cable's length inside, whichever comes first." They came almost together. The Diane rounded to, dropped her anchor, broke out her colours, and began her salute. Ordinarily, in the unknown port of an unknown island, Jack would have sent ashore to make certain that the salute would be returned gun for gun, the Royal Navy being very particular about its compliments. But Fox had assured him that the Sultan and his people laid great store by good manners and would never be found wanting in a matter of formal politeness. Even so, the prompt reply, well spaced and correct in number, was a relief to him. So was the fact that the answering guns were little more than swivels. In case of disagreement, it wouldn't be pleasant to lie within range of a battery of 18-pounders. With the last gun, a canoe put off from the shore. A high-prowed, tiger-headed canoe, with an outrigger and a deckhouse in the middle. It was paddled by 20 men, and it obviously carried an important person. "Mr. Fielding," said Jack, "side boys and man ropes, but no piping the side, no marines, I think." He looked across at Fox, who nodded. The canoe ranged neatly along. The important person, a slim brown man with a speckled orange tawny turban and a kriss tucked into his sarong, came aboard in a seaman-like manner and bowed gravely to those on the quarterdeck, putting his hand quickly to his forehead and his heart. At the same time, the canoe men raised some baskets of fruit on hooked poles to the hands on the gangway. Fox stepped forward, welcomed him in Malay, thanked him for the presents, and presented him to Jack, saying, "This is one da sent by the vizier. We should drink coffee with him in the cabin." The coffee drinking went on and on. From time to time, word came out, borne by Killick or Ali, once to lower down the launch, once to warn the gentlemen of the suite to stand by to go ashore, once to the mate of the hold to rouse their baggage up on deck. And during this time, Ahmed Yusuf and those Diane's who had any word of Malay conversed with the canoe men through the gun ports in the waist. At one point, Killick darted up, seized the baskets with an angry, suspicious glance all round, and disappeared again. Hope faded. The eager talk along the rail died away. But at 6 bells the word was passed for Mr. Welby, and the large cutter was ordered over the larboard side, where it was filled with baggage, servants, 5 marines and a corporal. And after another 15 minutes, Wanda, Mr. Fox and the captain came out. Wanda went down into the canoe and pulled off a little while the launch advanced for the envoy and his suite. As the 3 boats pulled away for the shore, the envoy's 13 guns boomed out again, and when the triple echo of the last had died away, Jack turned to Stephen and said, "Well, and so we've delivered him at last. There were times when I thought we should never do it." Stephen, who could perfectly well see that Fox had been or was just about to be set down on Pulau Prabang, frowned and replied, "Would there be any of that coffee left at all? I've been smelling it this last age, and never a sip sent out." "It appears," said Jack, as he led the way to the cabin, "that we were expected, and the vizier has set apart a fair-sized house in its own compound for the mission east of the river. The French have one on the other side. The Sultan will be back at the change of the moon, and then we shall both have our audience together." "When does the moon change?" asked Stephen. Jack looked at him. Even after so many proofs to the contrary, it was hard to believe that a man could remain ignorant of these fundamental things. But such was the case, and he said not unkindly, "In 5 days' time, brother."
As Shao Yan had told him, Lin Liang's house was comparatively small and inconspicuous. It faced onto a dusty lane that led from the street running along the east bank of the river, and with its shabby warehouses, it backed onto the outer edge of the town, not far from Fox's compound. The shop in front was crowded with goods. Blue and white china, huge rice jars, bales of blue cotton cloth, barrels, strings of dried squid, and dark, unidentifiable creatures hanging from the beams. But even so, it looked run down and poor. A Malay woman was buying a pennyweight of betel, lime and turmeric. And towards the back of the shop, idly fingering ginseng and shark's fins, stood Edwards and Macmillan, attended by Fox's younger servant, Yusuf. When the woman was gone, they pressed Dr. Maturin to take their turn. They were in no sort of a hurry. But although Stephen saw that they were moved by something more than good manners, he'd have none of it. He stood in the doorway watching the sparse traffic while they changed some money with Yusuf's help and then murmured their inquiries. Yusuf was less discreet, and his translation came shrill and clear. Two of these pieces for a short time, five for all night. When they'd gone, Stephen also changed a guinea and then said he would like to see Lin Liang. Calling another youth to keep the shop, the young man led him behind the two counters, through a storeroom, out into a court between the warehouses, and so to an enclosed garden with a stone lantern and a single willow tree. In the far corner there was a garden house with a round door, as round as a full moon, and in it stood Lin Liang bowing repeatedly. He advanced to meet Stephen halfway, conducted him to the little house, and sat him on a broad, outstandingly beautiful great chair made of Suchao lacquer, obviously brought for the purpose. He called for tea and port wine and cakes, which were carried in by a shabby, one-eyed eunuch, and after perhaps a quarter of a pint of tea, Dr. Maturin's liver, alas, wouldn't allow port wine, though he was most sensible of the attention, Lin Liang said apologetically that he had not yet been able to bring together all the money named in the esteemed Shao Yan's note, even with the help of his colleague on the other side of the river, the respectable Wu Han. But Wu Han was calling in an important debt, and within a week the sum would be made up. Meanwhile, Lin Liang had so arranged the available funds that he had an eighth part in pagodas and three quarters in rex dollars and taels, silver being much more current than gold in these regions at Dr. Maturin's disposal. And this, he said, shooting the balls of an abacus to and fro with extraordinary speed, represented certain proportions of the sequins, ducats, guineas, louis d'or and johannes deposited with Shao Yan. The numbers flowed past Stephen's ears, but he looked attentive, and when the calculation was done, he said, "Very good. I may make some considerable transfers quite soon, transfers that must remain confidential. Does Wu Han understand the importance of that? For I collect that he's associated with you in this undertaking." Lin Liang bowed. Wu Han was necessarily associated with him, and at half shares, the transaction being too important for either separately, but Wu Han was the soul of discretion, as silent as the legendary Mo. "Is he not the banker for the French mission?"
"Scarcely. They have sent to change a little money into Java guilders for daily marketing, but the only real connection is between Wuhan's Pondicherry clerk and a man belonging to the mission also from French India."
"Then please let it be known to Wuhan and his Pondicherry clerk that I should like any information about the French that can properly be given, lists of names and so on, and that I am ready to pay for it. But, Lin Liang, you understand as well as I do that in these things, discretion is everything." Lin Liang was wholly persuaded of it. Many of his own affairs, too, were of the most private nature. And perhaps for the future, Dr. Maturin might like to come by the door actually named Discretion, behind the hovel in which he and his miserable family had their unworthy being. He led Stephen through another court, surrounded by verandas, some with truly astonishing orchids hanging from the beams, and slim young women with bound feet tottering rapidly away. Still another, bounded by a high wall with a rounded projection whose spy-hole commanded the low iron door, and on the other side a lane, or rather a path, wandered along a neglected canal. Stephen wandered with it. He had some time to spare before his appointment with Van Buren, and he looked with more than ordinary attention at the orchids in the trees along the water or on the ground between them, an extraordinary variety of flowers and vegetation. He took specimens of those he couldn't recall having seen in Raffles' garden or dried collection, and he gathered up some beetles for Sir Joseph. Beetles that, in some cases, he couldn't even assign to a family, so far were they removed from his experience. By the time he reached Van Buren's door, he was somewhat encumbered. But in that house, burdens of this kind were taken for granted. Mevrouw Van Buren relieved him of the flowers, and her husband brought insect jars. "Shall we carry on directly with our viscera?" he asked. "I've reserved the spleen especially for you." "How very kind," said Stephen. "I should like it of all things." They walked slowly across the compound. Van Buren had a club foot, to the dissecting house, where they were anatomizing a portly tapir. The garden gate happened to be open, and as they passed it, Van Buren said, "If you were to use this when you do me the pleasure of paying me a visit, it might save time, particularly at night when the house is locked up and the watchman thinks all visitors are thieves. And time we must save, because in this climate specimens will not keep. Tapirs in particular go off as quick as mackerel, though one would hardly suppose it." His words were so true that they worked fast and silently, hardly breathing, sometimes shifting the mirrors that reflected strong light into the cavity, but communicating mostly by nods and smiles, though once, pointing to the tapir's anatomically singular forefoot, Van Buren murmured, "Cuvier." And when they thoroughly examined the spleen in all its aspects, taking the samples and sections necessary for Van Buren's forthcoming book, they sat outside to breathe the open air. Van Buren spoke luminously not only of this spleen, but of many spleens he'd known, the comparative anatomy of the spleen, and the erroneous notion of force hypomechanique. "Have you ever dissected an orangutan?" asked Stephen. "Only one," said Van Buren. "His spleen is on the shelf with the human examples, a pitifully meagre collection. It's very difficult to get a really prime cadaver in this country. Nothing but the occasional adulterer." "But surely criminal conversation, illicit venery, even grossly overindulged, will hardly affect a man's spleen." "It will in Pulo Prabang, my dear sir. The incontinent person is peppered. That is to say, a small sack, or rather bag, partially filled with pepper, is tied over his head. His hands are bound, and he is delivered over to the aggrieved family and their friends. They form a ring, beating the sack with sticks so that the pepper flies. Presently it kills him, and I have the corpse. But the prolonged and repeated convulsions that precede death distort the spleen most surprisingly, and so change its juices that they're useless for comparison. They do not support my theory at all." "Does the ape's spleen differ widely from ours?" asked Stephen after a pause. "Remarkably little. The renal impression above the posterior board, but I'll show you both without naming either, and you'll decide for yourself." "I should love to see an orangutan," observed Stephen. "Alas, there are very few down here," said Van Buren. "It was a great disappointment to me. They eat the precious durians, and they're killed for doing so." "Absurd as it may seem, I've never seen a durian either,"
Why, my battery is a durian. Let me show you. They walked out to the far end of the garden where a tall tree stood in a little enclosure of bamboos. There are my bats, said Van Buren, pointing to clusters of dark, almost black creatures about a foot long, hanging upside down, their wings wrapped about them. When the sun reaches the far trees, they'll begin to squeak and gibber, and then they'll fly off to the Sultan's garden and strip his fruit trees if the guardians don't take great care. Do they not eat your durians? Oh, dear me, no. I'll find one if I can. Van Buren stepped over the low fence, took a long forked pole, and peering up into the tree, he poked among the leaves. The bats stirred and muttered angrily, and one or two flew out in a circle, settling again higher up. A 5-foot wingspan. Some people eat them, remarked Van Buren, and then he cried, Take care! The durian fell with a heavy thump, an object the size and shape of a coconut, but covered with strong, thick-set spikes. The skin is far too thick for any fruit bat, he said as he cut it open, quite apart from the spikes. Ugly spikes. I've had several patients with dangerous lacerated wounds from a durian falling on their heads. The orangutan opens them, however, spikes, coriaceous skin and all. This one's quite ripe, I'm happy to say. Great try a piece. Stephen realised that the smell of decay came not from the dissection, but from the fruit. And it was not without a certain effort that he overcame his reluctance. Oh, said he a moment later, how extraordinarily good. And what an extraordinary contradiction between the senses of smell and taste. I had supposed them to be inseparably allied. How I applaud the orangutan's discrimination. They're charming animals, from what I've heard and what little I've seen. Gentle, deliberate, with nothing whatsoever of the baboon, the mandrill, or even the pongo, let alone the restless, petulant wantonness of monkeys in the general sense. But, as I say, there are almost none down here. To see my ass, for I believe that is the true Malay, you must go to Kumai. They long to do so. You've been there, I collect. Never, never. With this leg I cannot climb, and at the end of all possible riding, there are innumerable steps cut into the bare rock of the crater's outward side. The path is called the Thousand Steps, but I believe there are many more. I have an almost equal disadvantage. I am tied to this place until the negotiations are brought to an issue, I hope. A happy issue. Today I learnt of a connection that may prove useful. Early in their acquaintance, or indeed friendship, Stephen had found that Van Buren was utterly opposed to the French project, both because he hated Bonaparte and what he had done to Holland, and because he thought it would ruin Poulaprabang, which he loved. They had many friends in common, particularly the more eminent French anatomists. Each knew and appreciated the other's work. And for once in his career as an intelligence agent, Stephen had laid aside dissimulation. He now told Van Buren of his conversation with Lin Liang and of his hopes. And after that, as they sat on a shaded bench outside the dissecting room, Van Buren returned to his accurate, well-informed account of the members of the Sultan's Council, their virtues, shortcomings, tastes, approachability. I am infinitely obliged to you, dear colleague, said Stephen at last. The moon has risen, and I can see my way back into the town, where I mean to walk about among the bawdy houses and places where they dance. May I hope to see you later? I usually start work again in the cool of the night at about 2, and if we don't finish some of the finer processes before tomorrow's sun, they may scarcely be distinguishable. But before you go, let me tell you of a thought that occurs to me. Our Latif's half-brother is a servant in the house allotted to the French mission. He may be able to gather some small scraps of information about your man from Pondicherry.
These days, Stephen rarely saw either Fox or Jack Aubrey. He stayed ashore, usually sleeping in the favourite haunt of the small Javanese colony, a house where there were exquisite dancing girls and a famous Javanese orchestra, a gamelan, whose rhythms, intervals and cadences, though entirely foreign to his ear, pleased him as he lay there through the night by his scented sleeping partner. A young woman so accustomed to her client's peculiarities, some very bizarre indeed, that his passivity neither surprised nor displeased her. Here, in the main hall where the dancers performed, he sometimes met his shipmates, surprised, embarrassed, shocked by his presence. Mr. Blythe the purser, a kindly man and older than Stephen, took him aside and said, "I think I ought to warn you, Doctor, that this place is little better than a disorderly house. Prostitution often occurs." Gambling often occurred too. Very passionate gambling for very high stakes, sometimes going on till dawn. It was mostly moneyed people who came here, but he rarely saw any of the French, and never Ledward or Ray, who had gone to join the Sultan in his hunting, Ledward having some acquaintance with the Raja of Karwang. Once, however, he played with four Spanish shipwrights in the French service, who had brought their month's pay from the ship anchored in a remote creek to keep her people out of harm's way. He took their money from them. He'd always been lucky at cards, and a great deal of information. But on finding that they were most reluctant Frenchmen, he let them win it back again. He also let them suppose that he was a Spaniard in the English service, which, as they confessed, was natural enough, Spain and England now being allies. For their part, they'd been impressed as long ago as 1807, when another face of things was seen, and they had never been able to get away since. The rest of the time he walked about the countryside in a way that would be expected of a natural philosopher, the captain's guest. Sometimes with Richardson, sometimes with Macmillan, occasionally with Jack, but more often by himself. For his companions objected to the forest leeches that fastened upon them by the score in the wilder parts, and the tormenting flies and mosquitoes in the irrigated fields. They were most profitable walks, however, in spite of these disadvantages, and even in spite of a shockingly aggressive kind of bee that built its comb in the open, hanging from a stout branch, and that attacked on sight, pursuing the intruder for a quarter of a mile or to the nearest very thick bush, sometimes itself inhabited by still more ferocious red ants, or in one instance by an irritable female python coiled about her eggs. Quite early he chanced upon a broad track where woodcutters had dragged their timber down with teams of buffaloes, and this clear tract in the deep forest gave him wonderful views of the arboreal birds, particularly the hornbills, and sometimes of a mouse deer, while gibbons were far from rare. It was in this glade that Jack found him on the evening of a day during which he had had an unusually interesting conversation with Wu Han's Pondicherry clerk. "There you are, Stephen," cried Jack. "They told me you might be here, but if I'd known you was gone so far up the mountainside, I should have taken a pony. Lord, ain't it hot? Where you get the energy from after your nightly activities, I cannot tell, I'm sure." Like the rest of the ship's company, Jack had heard of the doctor's extraordinarily dissolute life, smoking and drinking until all hours, gambling. But he alone knew that Stephen could take the sacrament without confession. "To be sure," said Stephen, thinking of their work on the tapir, now a mere skeleton, "I was very busy last night. But you too would walk far up the mountainside without gasping if you didn't eat so much. You were much better physically when you were poor and wretched. What do you weigh now?" "Never mind. At least another stone and a half, perhaps 2 stone, God be with us.
You fellows of an obese and sanguine habit are always on the verge of an apoplexy, particularly in this climate. Will you not omit suppers, at least? Suppers have killed more than Avicenna ever cured. The reason I came sweating up this infernal hill, said Jack, was to tell you that Fox summons us both to a conference this evening. The Sultan returns tomorrow night, only a week after his appointed time, and we're to have our audience the day after. On the way down, he told Stephen how the ship was faring, and how the stores laid in at Andra, especially the great quantities of Manila cordage, were now being put to use, together with a detailed, perhaps a little too detailed, account of the restowing of the hold to bring her slightly by the stern. Just half a stroke or so, you understand. Nothing flash or outlandish or showing away. It pleased me very much indeed. But, shaking his head and looking melancholy, there was something else that didn't please me nearly so well. Having advised with Fox, I called all hands aft and told them that we were here to settle a treaty between the king and the sultan, and that the French were here too for the same purpose. That the French foremast jacks had gone ashore in droves and had given great offence by getting drunk, fighting, offering to kiss honest young women and touching their bare bosoms, and that they and their ship had been packed off to Malaria Creek. So, said I, the Dianes were not going to be given liberty except on promise of good behaviour, and even then only in small numbers at a time and with very little pay advanced. It was for their country's good, I said, only for their country's good. And I had thought of ending with God save the king or three cheers for the king. But somehow, by the time I'd finished, it didn't seem quite suitable. A sullen, dogged set, upon my word. Nothing but sour looks and wry faces. Even with Killigan Bondon, it's nothing but yes, sir, or no, sir. Never a smile. But then I'm no orator. The surprises might have worn it without oratory, because they know me, but not these swabs. They want to be ashore, tumbling a wench, and be damned their country's good. It is, after all, a very powerful instinct, perhaps the strongest of them all. I know your objections to having women aboard, but in this case, providing young Reed and Harper and perhaps Fleming were sent on shore, I can't see that any very grave moral harm is likely to ensue. Would you look after them? I would not. But a Fox, I've no doubt at all, he'd sell his soul for this treaty or attend to the needs of a whole orphanage. I shall ask him. Good evening, gentlemen, said Fox. How kind of you to come. May I offer you some East India ale? It's been hanging down the well in a basket. It's almost cold. He poured it out and went on. As you know, we're to have our audience of the Sultan the day after tomorrow, and as it is possible that I may be called upon to address his council immediately after the formal proceedings, I should be grateful for any observations that may strengthen our case. You know the position. The French offer a subsidy, guns, ammunition, and skilled shipbuilders. We offer a subsidy, I hope larger than the French, subsequent protection and some trading concessions, admittedly of no great importance, and there is always the implicit threat of what we might do after the war is over. The trouble is that one single Indiaman taken would be exceedingly damaging to us, and more immediately profitable than any subsidy I am empowered to offer. And in these parts, the outcome of the war seems by no means as certain as I could wish. Well, sir, said Jack, as far as the ships are concerned, and this is the only matter on which I am qualified to speak, you could point out that although the Malays are capital hands at building proas and small craft, I have indeed ordered a new pinnace, they have not the slightest notion of what we call a man of war. A real ship capable of bearing the weight of a deck of guns and the strain of firing them. And although the French ship shipwrights may understand their trade, they must necessarily be used to working oak and elm. And they, for their part, wouldn't have the slightest notion of these East Indies woods. Then you might tell them that although a proa can be run up in a week or so, a ship, a square-rigged ship, is quite another thing. In the first place, it needs a proper yard, a dock, a slip. Then, to take the example of a 74, the hull alone needs the seasoned timber, the seasoned timber, mind, of some 2,000 trees of about 2 ton apiece, with 47 shipwrights working a 12-month. Even a frigate like ours calls for 27 skilled hands to build her in a year, and when the ship is built at last, the men have to be taught to manage an unfamiliar rig and to handle the guns so that they're more dangerous to the enemy than to themselves. No easy task. The whole thing seems to me a scheme concocted in an office by a parcel of landsmen, if it's looked upon as one that'll give quick returns. Those are most valuable figures, said Fox, writing them down. Thank you very much indeed. But Paris may also have had in mind the potential threat that would compel us to weaken our forces elsewhere. A potential threat often has effects far beyond... But I'm not to be teaching you about strategy or tactics, he said with a smile. Doctor, can you add a shot to my locker? I have little definite to say at present, and I don't propose to trouble you with surmises, said Stephen. But I will observe that at least some of the shipwrights are impressed Spaniards, likely to run away to the Philippines as soon as ever they can. That at least some of the proposed French guns are said to be honeycombed, while at least some of the powders suffered extremely from wet during the voyage and from the gunner's negligence in omitting to invert the barrels in due sequence. That is all I have to report. But if I might be allowed a suggestion, I should say that by way of setting off Ledward's undoubted advantage in already having met the Sultan, having hunted with him and perhaps prepossessed him in his favour, it might be useful to invite His Highness to visit the ship the very next day and see the great guns fired. A thundering discharge of whole broadsides and the visible destruction of floating targets would both divert him and give him some notion of our capabilities. Yes, indeed. I shall certainly propose it to the Vizier at once. A very good idea in every way. He poured out more ale, already flat and tepid, and said, Now, unless anything else occurs to either of you, let me say something about our clothes for the audience. Splendour is everything on these occasions, and I have half the Chinese tailors in Prabang working on garments for our attendants. The officers are perfectly correct in their full dress, and my suite and I are properly provided. While the Marines, of course, couldn't do better. But I was wondering, Captain, whether your bargemen mightn't escort you carefully turned out, together with your officers and midshipmen, of course. And then, my dear Matron, what about you? A black coat, even a very good black coat, would hardly answer the purpose here. If it is splendour that is required, and if cloth and craftsmen are to be had, I shall go in my robes as a doctor of medicine, with scarlet gown and scarlet hood. And it was in a scarlet, or at least a Chinese red, gown and hood that he paced through the eastern gateway of the palace at Jack's side. A fairly rapid pace, because rain, furious tropical rain, was threatening, and the envoy had only one plumed hat. As fast as dignity allowed, the mission and all belonging to it advanced across the open space before the moat and the inner wall, 40 feet high and 12 thick, built by the Sultan's Javanese ancestors. They made a brave show,
headed by the envoy and a state horse in silver-studded crimson harness, led by grooms wearing sarongs and turbans made of cloth of gold, and the crew of the Diane's barge in new, white, broad-brimmed Senate hats with ribbons, brass-buttoned blue jackets, snowy duck trousers, black shoes with genteel bows and serviceable cutlasses by their sides, were particularly remarked. On through another courtyard, with the Sultan's men blowing trumpets and beating drums, and as the first warm, heavy drops splashed down into the palace. Fox's attaché loader might be in different company, but he was an excellent chef de protocole. And he and the vizier's secretary had arranged the placing of the mission with the utmost precision, the most exact regard for precedence. Each man filed into his allotted place along the eastern wall of the great hall of audience, with Fox and his immediate colleagues standing a few yards to the left of the empty throne. They stood there for some little time, listening not without satisfaction to the rain. And then they heard the drums and trumpets for the French. Duplessis came first in a gliding run, followed by his suite, four men in official uniform, and Ledward and Ray in bright blue coats with the star and ribbon of some order. Then the French naval officers and the troop of attendants, all of them more or less soaked. For the first moments, the French were wholly taken up with straightening their line, much upset by the last rush, and with their wet clothes, feathers and papers. But as soon as they'd settled in their due places, Duplessis, on the far side of the throne, looked across the open space and gave Fox what could just be described as a bow. It was returned with an exactly matching degree of cordiality. At the same moment, Ray caught sight of Stephen's scarlet robe and recognised first his face and then Jack Aubrey's with utter horror. He made a kind of harsh inward sob and grasped Ledward's arm. Ledward looked in the same direction. He stiffened, but betrayed no emotion, and the appearance of the Sultan at the far end of the hall diverted the attention of all, yet not before Stephen had noticed the expression of cold hatred on Fox's white-closed face, one that he'd rarely seen equalled. The Sultan advanced, shaded by fan-bearers, supported on either side by his great feudatories, and followed by the vizier and the members of his council. He was a good-looking man, tall for a Malay, about 45, and he wore a famous ruby in his turban. He advanced slowly, looking from side to side with a civil expression. The French had the strange notion of clapping as though at a theatrical performance, but he showed little surprise or displeasure. And when he turned to take his seat on the throne, he bowed to each side with equal courtesy. His attendants had all gathered in the space behind. But now the vizier, a small, dried man, stepped forward and stated in very respectful terms that two envoys had come, the first from the Emperor of France, the second from the King of England, and they begged to deliver their master's messages. The Sultan said, "In the name of Allah, the merciful and compassionate, let the first comer speak first." Duplessis, with Ledward behind him, took up his station before the throne, and having bowed, he began to read from his damp paper. A poor performance. The ink had run, the reader's spectacles were fogged with steam, and he himself was much oppressed by the heat and his wet uniform. Each paragraph was translated by Ledward. Very fluent translation, but also unconscionably free. And it was delivered in a hard voice, strangely at variance with its compliments and its expressions of goodwill and earnest desire for an even closer alliance between the cousins of Pulo Prabang and the French Empire. It had been agreed between the vizier and the two envoys separately that since the sultan intended to give a feast after the audience rather than hold a meeting of his council, the addresses shouldn't exceed a quarter of an hour. To the astonishment of their party, Duplessis and Ledward didn't speak so long. And Fox, who began badly, stumbling over the sultan's titles Flower of Courtesy, Nutmeg of Consolation, Rose of Delight, so that he had to repeat them twice, scarcely reached 10 minutes, in spite of a brilliant recovery and a much-admired evocation of the sultan's illustrious descent. When he came to an end, bowed and retired, the councillors exchanged covert looks of surprise, accustomed as they were to speeches that flowed on and on in self-generating eloquence. But the sultan, realizing his good fortune after a moment's silence, smiled and said, "In the name of Allah, the Merciful, the Compassionate, be welcome, gentlemen. Pray return our best thanks to your rulers, whom heaven preserve, for their noble presence, ever to be preserved both in our treasury and our heart, and let the feast commence." It was now that the value of sterling insensibility became evident. Fox was still so affected by this encounter, although it had long been expected, that his social powers were much obscured. But Johnson, Crabb and Loder talked away steadily, loudly, and with frequent bursts of laughter, and the head of the English table kept up a creditable din. This table ran the length of the banqueting hall, and in compensation for their position during the audience, the English were now placed on the sultan's right, his table crossing the head of the room. Stephen was quite far down, and as he was one of the few who could carry on a conversation in Malay, he had been placed between an elderly, morose and taciturn person whose function he never discovered, and Wanda, who had first received them. He was an agreeable neighbour. As a passionate hunter, he knew a great deal about the forest, the jungle and the higher mountain. "I saw you the other day above Ketang," he said, laughing cheerfully. "You were flying from the bees like a deer. Such leaps! It's a dangerous corner by the Red Rock. I had to run myself 5 minutes later, and I quite lost the track of my babarusa, a huge babarusa. A severe pang, I'm sure. But I hope it was mitigated a little by the reflection that swine's flesh is forbidden to Mahometans." "So is wine," said Wangda, smiling. "But there are days when the merciful, the compassionate, is even more merciful and compassionate than others. No, in fact, we kill them because they plough up the fields at night and because we use their tusks." The wine was real enough, however, a full-bodied, perfectly drinkable red whose origin Stephen couldn't make out. Conceivably Macau. And although it was served not in glass, but silver, he was reasonably sure that several of the Malays, as well as Wanda, were drinking it. The sultan certainly was. His cupbearer Abdul, a youth like a gazelle, made no pretense of hiding the dark red stream he poured. So with the French. While Wanda was giving a circumstantial account of his pursuit of a honey bear, Stephen examined the faces opposite him. The sea officers appeared to match the English reasonably well, and their captain had something of Linois' look, capable, efficient, determined and cheerful. Duplessis was not a man to send to a hot climate, not a man to send abroad at all, and his official counsellors were not unlike Fox's. Ray had fallen to pieces since Stephen last saw him. Flaccid, barely recognisable. The shock of recognition was still strong on him, and it was unlikely that he could sit out the meal, a greenish pallor increasing with every draught of wine. Ledward, on the other hand, now that he'd recovered his assurance, looked and sounded a formidable adversary. A man of quite unusual powers. Stephen watched him empty his goblet and hold it over his right shoulder to be refilled. And as he made this gesture, he glanced towards the throne with a very slight but significant change of expression. A private look. Stephen's eye darted to the left and just caught Abdul's answering smile. For some time, Stephen couldn't believe that his first impression wasn't a mistake. But although from this point on Ledward was perfectly discreet, Abdul, behind the Sultan, was not. And the impression grew to a moral certainty. The possible consequences so filled his mind that he lost the thread of Wanda's narrative until it ended, "So Tia-Udin killed the bear, and the bear killed Tia-Udin." "Jack," he said, as they walked along the rim of the crater to a point where they could hail the ship. "Did you reflect upon Ganymede at all?" "Yes," said Jack. "I was up with him all last night and should be this night were it not for the Sultan's visit tomorrow. Such an endearing little pale golden body as he peeps out. He's easily my favourite. But I shall still have him almost all night once the Sultan's done with." "Shall you, though?" said Stephen, looking at his friend's pleased, well-fed face, rather more florid than usual from the Sultan's wine. And after a pause, "Brother, can we be talking of the same thing?" "I should hope so," said Jack, smiling. "Jupiter's in opposition, you know. Nobody could have missed his splendour." "No, indeed, a very glorious sight. And Ganymede is connected with him, I collect. Of course he is the prettiest of the satellites. What a fellow you are, Stephen. How well named. But I meant another Ganymede, the Sultan's cup-bearer. Did you notice him?" "Well, yes, I did. I said to myself, why, damn my eyes, there's a girl. But then I remembered that there'd been no girls at a feast like that, so I returned to my excellent haunch of venison. No bigger than a hare's, but uncommon well-tasting. Why do you call him Ganymede?" "Ganymede was Jupiter's cup-bearer. And I believe their connection, their relations, their friendship would now be frowned upon. But I use the name loosely, as it is so often used. I mean no reflection upon the Sultan."